This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. Last week, we talked to Jim McRitchie, who I suggested could maybe be called a progenitor of the early version of what one day may be called the stakeholder capitalism movement. Wow, did I get all kinds of engagements on that one. My phone and email started blowing up from friends, former colleagues, acquaintances, distant family members. I see this chatter as part of the logic behind the short-form interview format of What Does It Profit? Let's face it, we can't cover any of these big, heady ideas about the social and moral value of business in this format. So you might ask, what's the point? Think about it this way. I'm many things, as are all of us, right? You know, you're a doctor, a lawyer, a clerk, a custodian, whatever role it is you play in the world. We all have different identities. But the identity that I share with you on the show is that I'm a former investment banker with the heart of a teacher. You can think about the Wednesday show of What Does It Profit as your weekly lecture, meant to put some ideas out there and give you some framework for a homework assignment. That homework assignment is to dig deep from where you sit and ask yourself how the values floating around in these conversations are relevant in your world. Now, those of you who are new, WDIP, or WDIP, is one of those long line of acronyms that show up on the show. Pay attention, because this one is one that you definitely want to remember. Because this is the point. On What Does It Profit, we are all about creating community. And you can't have community without interaction. And in my philosophy, this is everyone, in civil terms, making a contribution. You can learn more about this idea in my interviews this past week on a few special podcasts. More in the outro to today's show about all of this. This week, we're going to take this storytelling idea to a whole new level. We are going to talk with a man whose Instagram feed is laced with selfies of the Hollywood superhero A-list. In many ways, I like to think of our guest today as kind of a superhero himself. Sure, he's dressed up and gone to superhero conventions, or Comic-Cons, as they like to say. Heck, he invented one of the most innovative and dynamic Comic-Cons. Today, we're talking with Garib Shamus, former chairman and CEO of Wizard Entertainment, and the co-founder and CEO of Ace Comic-Con. Why am I interested in introducing you to Garib, you might be asking? Because he reminds me of something profound that applies to all of us, whether you're into the superhero culture or not. Garib tells us that we are all a superhero at something. And heroism is an important virtue in our lives and in our work. In the time of COVID, we understand this idea more than ever, right? In that vein, I'm going to use my voice to shout out to all the entrepreneurs I spoke with on Monday in the DMV, yes, another acronym, DC, Maryland, and Northern Virginia, through the Team Network. These are inspiring entrepreneurs that keep all of us going. Now, they're superheroes too. Other superheroes? Healthcare workers, of course, heroes. Teachers, heroes. Sanitation workers, heroes. And a special shout out to Marquita and Michelle, who are the receptionists and security guards at the new production offices of What Does It Profit? Talk about frontline duty. Looking forward to getting to know both of you better. And I would be remiss, of course, if I didn't introduce you to the Solomons. Solomon Squared, I like to say. The two fellows that take care of the parking garage at St. Matthew's Cathedral, right next to, of course, the WDIP new production office. More about that all throughout the process of getting to know each other. All right, let's get us out of Washington. Today, we're going to New York, Miami, Hollywood, and beyond. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, Garib Shamus. Garib is going to be, I think, one of my favorite guests this season. Garib, if you don't mind, I'm going to call you superhero guru. I'm going to call you the dean of the nerds. We could go on and on, but let's just first say hello. Welcome. Welcome to What Does It Profit?
Oh, thank you so much. And I like all those titles and I've been called way worse. So those are actually pretty good.
That's good. We really are a business show that talks about the moral and social value of business, which may not be the kind of interview you're used to. You play in a completely different world. And that's why we're really excited to have you. So Garib, let's talk about comics. For our listeners who are just now being introduced to Garib, Garib is kind of the godfather of all things comic in the modern era, the founder of Comic-Con. Can I ask you a personal question?
Of course, yes.
What was the first comic book you ever gotten? And were you immediately hooked after that first one?
Yes, but it goes back even well before the superhero stuff into the days of Archie Comics and then Richie Rich, things like that, where, you know, I just loved those comic books growing up. And then that brought me into Mad Magazine. And
classic.
Then Mad Magazine ultimately, wound up getting into the kind of the superhero genre. And so, yeah, it's been an incredible journey. And, you know, I've been fortunate. I have three brothers that we just all grew up reading comic books and trading sports cards. So it was a really fun childhood.
Well, I called you out as a nerd, maybe unfairly, my listeners may think, but I think you take that as a badge of honor. Tell us about your nerdy roots.
Oh, there's no question that when people call me that, I always luckily had a lot of self-confidence as a kid. And anytime somebody thought of me as a geek or a nerd, I felt like they were addressing me properly. Like that's exactly what I wanted to be. So whereas it felt like, you know, people would use those words interchangeably back in the day to bully kids. This to me was like, that's great. You know, I love this stuff. And I almost took it one step further and couldn't even understand why they didn't like this stuff. And so, yeah, I'm totally with you. For me, it's like people thought you had like a virus or something if you were into superheroes.
Oh, well, I got the other end of nerdy. I'm the one who had my head in a book and would retreat to my room after dinner with no contact in the outside world. And I'd sit, you know, and dutifully do my homework. So I was on the other end of the spectrum. But it's interesting to me. One of the things we like to do in choosing the guests on our show is to think about what is it in their story or in their world of work or what kind of legacy they've built for themselves in the process of building out their careers? And we look for a kind of a human value that's at the heart of what you're doing. And what really attracted me about your story is this idea that I see through your story, I'm seeing is this desire to build community and to combat, you know, isolation and marginalization. You know, am I reading you right?
Yeah, that's exactly the line that has gone through literally everything I've done in my life. It's all about building community and making people feel special and part of something that that they could be proud of and excited about. You know, it reminds me of the story when we hosted our first Comic-Con and, you know, we're talking about the geeks and the nerds. You're talking, you know, decades ago, 25 years ago, where like we were talking about being a nerd or geek was being an outcast. And, you know, you were loners and you were considered a loser. And when we held our first Comic-Con and we had about 10,000 people show up, all of a sudden these disenfranchised people, everyone who thought that they were a loser or a loner, came together and realized there was a lot of people like themselves. And that really galvanized the whole movement. And it was just one of those extraordinary, you know, things for me to realize the impact, you know, that we were having out there.
Now, Garib, on What Does It Profit? We have a process by which we try to find interesting guests who really have an interesting story to tell about how they live out a human value. And what really struck us about the work that you do is this through line that we see about kind of combating exclusion and marginalization and the affirmative value of creating community. And in pop culture, I think you're at the top of the list. You're the founder of Comic-Con, but you know, it started way before that. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so for me, a community and bringing the marginalized or people that have been disenfranchised together has always been at the heart of everything that I'm doing. Because I've been involved in a world where we can tell stories and any stories with any characters, and we can make anybody feel like they're part of that. So my whole career has been, how do I use those tools and those heroes as a way to bring people together? And I found that throughout my life, almost everything I've done, it becomes the first thing that I gravitate towards, which is, how do I take advantage of the fact that I know how to bring people together? And I love doing that. And I love doing it in my personal life too. Everywhere I go, you know, I love going to social events. I love introducing people to one another. And I've been able to luckily carry that throughout my whole life.
Well, I think it's a gift. There are people who have it and there are people who don't. And I think about all of the people's careers who have been impacted by your ability to put people together. I think I heard a story once about one of the outcomes of the activities that come out of Comic-Con is the personification of these characters. And I heard a tale, and I don't know if it's true, so I'm going to ask you, that years before Batman was made, you and your network and community created a wonderful focus group for the big movie studios to figure out what their characters were going to look like. And did I hear that maybe you had picked Ben Affleck to be Batman?
Yes, it's so funny you remember that. Back in my early days, my first venture as a professional in the business was to start a magazine about comic books. And every month in the magazine Wizard, what we would do is we would cast movies that we would want to see, because at the time they weren't even making them yet. And one of the movies that we wanted to see was Batman. And so what we did was we cast which actors we think would play the characters the best. And we actually cast Ben Affleck back in 1999. We cast Ben Affleck to come back in the Batman films. And it's just so funny that almost, I think, 16 to 18 years later, that's exactly what had happened.
You were ahead of your time, pioneer, visionary, and in so many ways. So that's a nice story.
Yeah, there's so many examples of that, because it was all kind of an open world. So much of this stuff hasn't been done. So many of these movies had not been made, or TV shows have been made, or just so many aspects of our world just hadn't been kind of quote unquote exploited yet. Everything that was in our imagination, we could put into the magazines or have it at our events and be able to show the world what we're doing and how we're thinking about it and really be on the cutting edge of that whole world.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that world. So you start in the magazine space, and I have a feeling that part of the story is kind of the story of technology, but then you go to live events. And then in comes gaming and movies. How did all that work?
So what happened was, when I started back in 1990, I'd graduated from college and I was 21 years old. And my mom had a comic book store. We had that in the family as a kid. It had grown so much from a hobby, me and my brothers, to now kind of a professional operation. And I didn't have a job, and I wound up creating a newsletter about comic books. But the fascinating thing was, back in 1990, the way the printing and publishing business worked, you had to have hand presses and what they call cut rubies and wax machines and all these very sophisticated equipment in order to make a printed page. But me, I had my Mac computer and all the new software that was coming out back in the late 80s. So here I was, this 21-year-old kid in my house, in my basement, you know, being able to make magazines and printed a newsletter. And I was able to do it at a way that even the biggest publishers in the world couldn't do. So I kind of used technology very early on to produce a newsletter about comic books, and then ultimately was able to turn that into a magazine about comic books. When we did that, our first issue launched, and people were really excited about it, because I was basically a kid. And the magazine, even though I was 21, 22, the magazine was basically reaching 14 and 15 year olds. So I wasn't much older than my audience, and just telling our fans of what was coming out and what they should be looking for and what we love. And we spoke to them as our friend, and it really resonated with people.
Comics and Comic-Con and this space hasn't always been the place that you've worked. You've expanded in other media area. I'm really interested to know, how did you find your way into professional fighting? Yes, listeners, you didn't mishear what I said. You know, we went from comic books and superheroes to, I guess superheroes may be the connection, but for you, how did you make that leap?
Well, when we were doing the Comic-Cons, business had exploded for us. We had our first event. We We had about 10,000 people come, and ultimately it had grown into the hundreds of thousands of people. And if you kind of break it down into its core, it was really bringing guys together about something that they're passionate about. And I could be talking about mixed martial arts. I could be talking about superheroes. I could talk about sports cards or sports. And then also, you know, when you think about people who are mixed martial art fighters, you know, they're larger than life. They're physically stronger than their peers. And that's really what kind of drew me to that. You know, I knew how to get a lot of people into one place at one time. And I had a friend that was interested in the fight business. We kind of got together and we said, hey, if we do mixed martial arts fights, how would that work? And I knew how to rent arenas. I knew how to sell tickets. I knew how to produce live television. I knew how to do all those kinds of things. So why not do it in the mixed martial arts world? And one thing led to another. And it turns out that because we worked with a lot of the talent agents, because of the celebrities that we worked with, a lot of them represented the fighters too. So it was very easy to go from one area to the next for me.
Was it sequential or was it layered on top of what you were doing in your day job? How does this fit into the story you tell about your career trajectory?
Well, it all started kind of simultaneously. So while I was still working on my Comic-Cons and the magazines, I was building this mixed martial arts organization simultaneously, until it got to the point where it required my full time. So I wound up leaving my Comic-Con business for a little bit to work on the mixed martial arts.
And then what happened?
So I wound up getting a license in about 14 states to put on mixed martial arts events. I wound up hosting about 20 live arenas. I had about 100 fighters under contract. We were on television on Fox. We were also doing events all over the country, and it was really kind of spectacular about how that grew. And then ultimately, it was still very nascent at the time, because you're talking about 2005, 2006, even 2007. Even though the sport was growing tremendously, there wasn't a lot of dollars in the sport. There was pay-per-views for the UFC, but there really wasn't a lot of sponsorship dollars for that world. So I wound up turning over the reins to a friend, that company, and then I wound up headed back to my wizard business because there was some challenges there that needed me.
Well, I mean, you find yourself back then in this traditional, I guess you'd say, superhero world, or more what we outside of the industry think of as the superhero space. But I think I heard you say once something that was quite poignant. I'll put you on the spot, but ask you for a little commentary. I've heard you say everyone is a superhero at something. You think that's true?
Absolutely. Anybody that I meet, or anybody that I know or can think of, they are great at something. And maybe they discovered it, or maybe they haven't yet. But I do think that there is something inside of everybody that makes them excel beyond their peers. Every time you say to somebody, wow, I don't know how you did that, you know, to me, that alone kind of says to them that you're amazing at something. And I really believe that. And sometimes people go through life and they never discover that. And it's a shame whether they are not in a circumstance where they can, or they never discover that ability, or they never take enough chances or try things. But the people that do, you really see how they can do that. And when you look at whether it's people that are literally rock stars in the music world, or sports athletes, or business executives, or people that invent things, or people that are artists. I mean, when you look at almost any area of life, you know, there are people that grew up with the same resources that many of us have grown up with, but yet, you know, they've been able to excel beyond their peers. So I really believe that exists inside of everybody.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thought. And I guess that is a lens by which we can all be inspired to grow and develop to be our best selves.
Absolutely. There's no question. I mean, there's so many professions that exemplify that. I mean, people that are, whether they're in the military or they're police or firemen or they're doctors or nurses, I mean, the ability to help others, those are not anything I could ever do in life, just not within me, not to help people, but just to do those type of those type of jobs, especially like a fireman, the idea that if there's a fire, everyone's natural instinct is to run away, but their instinct is to run in. How do you even develop that mindset, right? Me, those are those kind of superheroic things that really kind of get me excited.
Sure. Yeah. In these days of COVID, I mean, you just drive past a hospital. It's, you know, superheroes without the capes. I think I've seen that in my travels in and around during this past year. And I think it's true.
Yeah, there's no question that I do think that COVID has shown a light on people that we either take for granted or we overlook on a daily basis that have really been so tremendous in making sure that the population at large was fed and taken care of properly. I was in New York City, virtually like the epicenter of U.S. when COVID broke out. And at, I think it was at 7 o'clock at night, everybody would be banging pans outside the window for the hospital workers and for all the emergency personnel that would help out. I would go to the supermarket and thank everybody for showing up and packing our groceries or helping us at checkout. I mean, and filling the shelves. I mean, again, it's not something that you may have thought about, but these people, you know, really kind of risk their own lives to help so many others.
No, clearly. And I think it's, in my mind, it's kind of like music. Music can bring people who come from totally different places in life together, either to kind of express something that they can't say in their own words, or to shout it in a collective way that might not have been possible. I see superheroes kind of the same way. People can identify with them, kind of what's at stake in the story of that superhero, and say, hey, well, I feel a little bit of that in my own life.
There's no question that's why superheroes have excelled in the last 10 years, because they are role models. We kind of live in a world absent leadership that people believe in. And whether it's this country or a lot of other countries, people have definitely lost that looking up to their leaders. And a lot of people have turned to superheroes for that. And then also there's a lot more of a humanity there. Take somebody like even a Spider-Man type character. Or Spider-Man, right? It's someone who is has a responsibility, a great responsibility. And so many of us, you know, want to live our daily life, but yet feel that we have some greater responsibility, whether it's taking care of someone else in our family or having to provide for others, despite the fact that we want to just kind of be a kid or be on our own. These stories resonate with people, and that's what's the attraction to them. And it's also provided a kind of a fantasy world for people to be able to delve into, because it's not just these one-off type stories. They're sequential and they're iterative, meaning that you don't just have one Spider-Man film, you have multiple Spider-Man films, but also it weaves within the Avengers family. And you see that all the time, whether it's Star Wars or Harry Potter or any number of franchises out there where people can get immersed in these stories and really identify, right? How many times do you hear even something as much as like a Harry Potter, like which house are you? Are you Gryffindor or are you Slytherin, right? It's like people identify.
Oh yeah, that's right. Well, talk about getting immersed. It wasn't too long ago that I was walking home from Sunday church through my neighborhood here in Washington, D.C. I look up and I see this, what was otherwise a vacant storefront. And in that storefront, there was a sign. It said Commander Salamander. And I thought, wow, I haven't seen this store since the 80s. So I walk right in. And then, you know, the shelves are stocked. And it looks like the store that I remember from the 80s. And I get a tap on my shoulder. And it's one of the members of the production crew who was setting up to shoot Wonder Woman 84. And I thought, I just walked on a movie set right there in my neighborhood. And we were waiting for what seemed like forever for it to come out. And I don't know if, you know, our listeners, you know, have had this experience too, where you, you know, walk down the street and say, hey, I've recognized that from my neighborhood's in that movie. So that's how, you know, superheroes literally came close to home for me.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? I was in New York City while they were shooting a bunch of the Spider-Man films. And yeah, and it's like, so every time Spider-Man would swing down the street, I'd be like, oh, I know that building, and I know that building, and I've been down here. And yeah, it's really, it's so great to be able to identify that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the magic of entertainment and the movies and all of that. I think it's a gift to our culture in many ways. I mean, sure, there's a lot of lousy stuff to be found, but there are oftentimes those gems that just stay with you from generation to generation.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of the superhero world, is that it has gone generational. And that was the kind of the magic of when Disney acquired Marvel. Disney already had a very deep relationship with women and their daughters and the princesses, and how that really, they kind of had that female to female relationship. And when they bought Marvel, they kind of bought into this whole idea of the father-son relationship and the guys. And that's when all of a sudden Disney had the entire family. And once they were able to start making the Marvel films, they were able to figure out how to not just produce these characters for guys, but how to really include women and girls and boys and really make it a whole family event. And then it was generational. So it was so easy for especially a guy that grew up with these characters to be able to bring their kids and relive those childhood dreams with their family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think about what Marvel's doing kind of in the social justice space with these new superheroes that are addressing identities that our broader society is just opening up to. Think of Snowflake, the non-binary character, or Trailblazer, actually is one of my favorites, the overweight girl, the one who's the foster child who volunteers in the senior center. Like, that's real. And it's fun to see that kind of stuff. I don't know where that will go or how it fits into the broader industry, but it's an observation that I've seen from the outside that just looks like something new and different.
Well, comic books have always been on the forefront of what's going on in our culture. And, you know, a big part of that was Stan Lee and how he thought about bringing people together and really breaking down barriers. You look at Marvel, like with Blade and then Black Panther. I mean, these were characters that were created decades and decades ago. It's only been recent that movies and have come out on them, especially with Black Panther. That was a character that's been around for a long time. And it's only been recently where Hollywood has felt that you could have a film with Black actors and Black lead and tell that type of story. And look what's happened. The results have been extraordinary in terms of how big on a global scale that's been. And quite frankly, the same thing is, as much as it's even hard to say too, it's like it's with women too, right? It's like it's taken a long time, you know, for there to be a strong female lead in a character like Wonder Woman, for somebody like that to even have a strong lead in a major motion picture in the superhero genre. So
yeah, that happens to be set in Washington, D.C., where women have been marginalized for a long, long time.
Absolutely. And I think we're finally at that era where it's so much in the consciousness now that people need to be aware of it and are not only are aware of it, but it's become part of who they are to be able to be inclusive of everyone. And to be able to know that we live in a world where everybody's here, everyone's going away, so we all have to live together and address these issues.
Yeah, you mentioned Stan Lee, Will Eisner, these just icons that maybe set the tone or gave a lot of inspiration and motivation to the generations like yourself that have come after. I understand you had I don't know if pen pal is the best way to describe it, but a letter writing experience or exchange with Stan Lee.
Yes. Stan was like a godfather to me. And Will Eisner too. I mean, one of the forefathers of our business. They were around for a long time. And especially in my early days, when I was in my early 20s, every time I would see Stan, he would give me a big hug and he'd be so supportive of everything that I was doing with the magazines and the comic cons. And he was just so excited. It was almost like he was a kid again, that he could be part of a world that embraced these characters. So for so long, he was the one on the forefront of that battle to get everyone to be excited about comic books and these characters. And he was the one that was so encouraging to me. So what would happen is every time I felt like it, I'd write him a letter about something that was going on in my life or his life. And I kind of knew secretly that he would write me back. So over the years, I've got about a dozen letters that Stan has written me based on letters I've probably written him. And so these are just cherished pieces for me, you know, that I kept, you know, these handwritten notes that Stan signed and made jokes. And he even wrote a letter how much he hates me because...
What was that about?
Yeah, most people did not know this, but he was a yo-yo expert. He was incredible with a yo-yo. And so I bought him an incredible yo-yo and I sent it to him. And then he sent me a letter that he wrote back and it starts out, Garib, I hate you, because he hasn't been able to get any work done because he's been playing with his yo-yo all day. And those kind of things where he would send me letters about one time he, very early on when I started the magazine, somebody at my company comes into my office and they hand me a check from Stan Lee for a subscription to the magazine. And we were getting a lot of subscription checks at the time. And I'm like, how would you even have found this? And they said, well, it got kicked back because he never signed it. So I was like, oh. So I call up Stan and I said, Stan, I said, look, I said, first of all, I said, you never have to pay for a subscription to the magazine. I said, I'm going to send you that for free. I said, but secondly, you never signed the check. I said, the check is worth more than the subscription. So that was it. I left it. And then a couple weeks later, I get a letter from Stan making fun of me, but included was a check for a dollar that he signed Stan Lee.
Is that framed on your wall somewhere?
Check, of course. Yeah, I never cashed it. I have it, the letter and the check.
Wow, that's a great story. And maybe by way of background, you can share with our listeners a little bit of the backstory of Stan Lee, give him a little bit of context for those listeners who are maybe not as familiar with the history of the industry.
Oh, so back in the early days, the industry started around with the Batmans and the Supermans, and even before that, but just kind of the icons that people know today. So there was Siegel and Shuster and Bob Kane, and you had those extraordinary people that created those characters for DC Comics. And then a company had started with Stan Lee, with Marvel, and he started creating these incredible characters, the most iconic ones that we know today, characters like, you know, Spider-Man and Captain America and the Hulk. It was just incredible, the imagination that he had back in the day and how he would use these just his ability to tell stories and make these characters. And he really had this human touch, and he was the best at the way people interacted with one another and how humans spoke to each other, and then how you could add this level of superheroicness to it and take it to another level. And not only that, but he was also, he had such a big mouth in the best of ways. He was the most vocal person for the industry. So he was kind of like the best spokesperson for it. He had, his personality was as large as his characters, if not bigger. And that really helped bring the comic book industry to a global basis, because everywhere in the world, these characters were known, and he would be the guy behind it.
Yeah, and I understand the world lost Stan not too long ago.
Yeah, it was not too long ago. He passed away. He was in his mid to high 90s. So he lived a long, fruitful life. He touched everyone. What was really amazing too was the stories about, like, how I even talked about him and how close my relationship and how fond of him I was and how amazing he was to me. When he passed away, I heard and saw so many stories of people feeling the same way. And it was just so extraordinary to know that somebody could touch so many people and feel like he was able to make them feel as special as everybody else. And so you would see pictures, not just of me, but have thousands of just normal, everyday people that got to meet him, talk about how extraordinary he was. And then you'd see pictures of Jeff Bezos hanging out with him, feeling like a kid too. And he always made everyone feel like they were the most important person. And so he never saw your economic background or your social background or your educational background. He just saw people that were just incredible and brought out the best of everyone.
Well, I think that's aspirational for all of us who, as we think about the work that we do in the world, maybe we all could be a little bit more like Stanley.
Absolutely. There's no question that anybody that he's had that impact on feels that motivation to carry that on. And certainly I do. In everything that I do, you know, I aspire to always kind of go back to trying to make people feel that way. And it's tough. It's not like it came so naturally to him, but yet it's something that's just, I think, so important, especially being in the world that I'm in.
Yeah, well, you're in a lot of worlds. I mean, this maybe is a nice segue to talk about some of the other kind of work that you do that I think, again, typifies this through line of building community. But, you know, you're an artist yourself.
Yes, so I am. I started painting probably about 6.5 years ago. It was one of these things where I was taking a break and I thought I was going to be a writer. And I had a lot of ideas for film and TV shows and comic books. So I started writing, and it turns out that I had the ideas, but not the discipline for sitting down. And so I think I'm also way more of a visual person. So then one day I had this idea for painting of what a great way to be able to tell my stories using paint. So I went to the store, I started buying paint, and then I became pretty obsessive compulsive over the first like 6 to 9 months, where I started creating patterns and colors that really were able to tell stories. I felt like I had a very blessed life. I have 2 kids, super healthy. My family is amazing. And I felt like I wanted to be able to spread that positive and optimism around. So I started working on different colors and patterns and different ways of creating these paintings where I drop paint on the canvas and have tens of thousands of drops on my paintings. And it was just incredible, like how I was able to express myself. And I was doing it for fun. And then one day a friend of mine had introduced me to an art dealer who loved my work and actually gave me a show in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And that's when I caught the bug. I sold one of my paintings. And then I was like, wow, I love this. I love the idea that I can have a gallery. I invited all my friends in New York there. I had 300 plus people in New York come out to my show and be able to celebrate my art with me. And I love that aspect of how I could use art to bring people together and use my art as a way to also get people together. So it wasn't just me being able to express my art, but then my art being out there and then other people being able to talk to other people about it and what it means and how it makes them feel.
I want you to talk a little bit about an aspect of that art that maybe you hadn't thought to bring up, but you can actually touch it, right? I mean, you feel it. I mean, you go to some museums and you're not, it's like, whoa, like 10 inches away from the wall. You know, don't go anywhere close, but you have a little bit different take on your art.
Yeah, so my art is, the process for my art is very unique. I use very similar to pastry tools that I've had to customize. And I drop paint on the canvas and it's all very three-dimensional and all the paint comes to a point and every drop is very deliberate on the canvas. And I create these patterns. And what happens is when you look at it, if it's hanging on the wall, depending on how the light hits it, it casts shadows, the drops cast shadows. So every time you look at my painting, it's different. It does, because it has a three-dimensionality, but I wanted it to be very textural. It has this sculptural quality to it, but it also has this texture quality to it, and it's also a painting. And I wanted to be able to add those kind of dimensions to it. And it's just really fascinating, because even I sometimes am amazed at how it creates this dimensionality to it that even I don't realize until I'm done.
Yeah, we're not all able to get out, or, you know, none of us really are able to get out and get to museums and get to these public places right now, just the reality of a pandemic world. How do our listeners see some of your work?
Oh, so all my work is online, whether it's on my Instagram account, which is my name at Garib Seamus, or my website, which is garibseamus.com. Luckily, my name is a little weird, so it's easy to get the .coms and stuff so people can find me there. And yeah, what I do online is not only do I show the front of the painting, but I also do zooms of the side. So I zoom in on the side so you can see what it looks like up close. And it definitely creates this tension in a good way, where when people see it, they want to touch it. And even though they're sharp points, you still feel like you want to touch, reach out and touch it. So it really creates this wanting to do an action versus being very passively viewing the art.
Yeah. We always ask our guests here at What Does It Profit the quintessential show question, which is the work that you're doing. And maybe this is just a riff on the expression we talked about earlier in the conversation, everyone is a superhero at something. But you think about the wonderful experiences you've had in building an incredible career and a multifaceted career, and the legacy that you leave, and really this creative legacy of building communities in all different kinds of ways. What does it profit?
So for me, it's this idea that if you can think it, you can do it. And I've always felt that I was maybe put on this earth or here at this time to be able to change the world and to make people feel like they're part of something greater, or they're included in something, or that they can discover something or express themselves or forge their imaginations. And I feel like I've been given that gift to create platforms or abilities to do that. So it's almost like it's my obligation to do that. And I'm always thinking about ways that I can share that and give more people. And when you think about like even the idea of Comic-Con and how we've been able to create this idea of cosplay where people dress up and imitate their favorite characters, or being able to discuss superheroes or the whole kind of fandom component to it. You know, it's how many other industries have been able to take those things and apply it to their own worlds and multiply those experiences and those shared experiences. We're in a great world right now where technology has given us the ability to do it so much bigger and so much greater and so much faster. And I'm going to just keep inventing ways to create opportunities for people to get together and create communities around the things that they love.
Yeah. And I get the sense that there's more to come from you. So we're going to keep an eye out on what's your next big adventure. So we'll wish you lots of luck. We thank you for spending some time thinking about these really important issues. Thanks, Gera. We're glad to have you as a guest.
Thank you. It's always fun to talk about superheroes.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? Thanks to those who've gotten the word out about the show. This week, I want to draw your attention to a California-based show, this week's Hustlers for a Cause, whose conversation with me was called The Hidden Cost of Capitalism. In this episode, I answered the question of how to relate the spirit of What Does It Profit for their audience of entrepreneurs. We talked about a lot of things in this 18-minute episode, but what I think was most important was the conversation about legacy. My answer might not be the one you expect. In our next episode, we're going superhero. This time, we're going to the Walt Disney Corporation for probably not quite the conversation you expected. But I do have to shout out solidarity to the wild ride at the Golden Globes earlier this week. No, the folks at Pixar have not invited us over yet, but we will have an inspiring conversation with the brand new Manager for Diversity and Inclusion for the corporate segment of the Walt Disney Company, Logan Scott. Logan inspired us in February with his work in Black History Month with the New York Times' Nicole Hannah Jones and other writers from the New York Times and the New York Times Magazine. If you didn't catch any or all of it, Google it, YouTube it, whatever. It's very interesting work that tells the American story by framing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of our national narrative. Bravo, Nicole. Bravo, New York Times. Bravo, Logan. Next on What Does It Profit? The Manager for Diversity and Inclusion in the corporate segment of the Walt Disney Corporation. We talk with veteran HR leader and brand new cast manager, our friend, Logan Scott. Until next time, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. Again, we're hanging out mostly on LinkedIn and Twitter at the moment. And please don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. You can meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by Lucy Wang and edited by Switch and Board Studios. Our executive producers are me and veteran public radio producer Jordan Gosporé. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean, other team members, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?